This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
It's time for Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at ORFM Dunedin.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you in Arabic. My name is Arina Aizal and I'll be your host for the Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation today. In today's episode, we have an interview with Brother Hamza Siddiqui, originally from India, a PhD candidate at the Department of Orthodontics, Faculty of Dentistry, University of Otago. We begin, though, with a recitation of the Quran by Sheikh Sa'ad Al-Ghamdi, Surah 10, Yunus, Jonah, verses 31 to 36. The passage reminds us of the truth and almightiness of the Creator and warns against following our own assumptions and conjectures.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul man yarzuqukum minas samaa'i wal ardi amman yamliku as-sam'a wal absar أَمَّنْ يَمْلِكُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَمَنْ يُخْرِجُ الْحَيَّ مِنَ الْمَيِّتِ وَيُخْرِجُ الْمَيِّتَ مِنَ الْحَيِّ وَمَنْ يُدَبِّرُ الْأَمْرِ فَسَيَقُولُونَ اللَّهُ فَقُلْ أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ فَذَلِكُمُ اللَّهُ رَبُّكُمُ الْحَقُّ فَمَاذَا بَعْدَ الْحَقِّ إِلَّا الضَّلَالُ فَأَنَّى تُصْرَفُونَ كَذَلِكَ حَقَّتْ كَلِمَةُ رَبِّكَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ فَسَقُوا أَنَّهُمْ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ قُلْ هَلْ مِنْ شُرَكَائِكُمْ مَنْ يَبْدَأُ الْخَلْقَ ثُمَّ يُعِيدُهُ قل الله يبدأ الخلق ثم يعيده فأنى تؤفكون قل هل من شركائكم من يهدي إلى الحق قل الله يهدي للحق أفمن يهدي إلى الحق أحق أن يتبع أمن لا يهدي إلا أن يهدى فما لكم كيف تحكمون وما يتبع أكثرهم إلا ظنا إن الظن لا يغني من الحق شيئا إن الله عليم بِمَا يَفْعَلُونَ
Translation of the recited verses. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Say, Prophet, who provides for you from the sky and the earth? Who controls hearing and sight? Who brings forth the living from the dead and the dead from the living? And who governs everything? They are sure to say, God. Then say, so why do you not take heed of him? That is God, your Lord, the truth. Apart from the truth, what is there except error? So how is it that you are dissuaded? In this way, your Lord's word about those who defy the truth has been proved. They do not believe. Ask them, can any of your partner gods originate creation then bring it back to life again in the end? Say, is it God that originates creation and then brings it back to life? So how can you be misled? Say, can any of your partner gods show the way to the truth? Say, God shows the way to the truth. Is someone who shows the way to the truth more worthy to be followed or someone who cannot find a way unless he himself is shown? What is the matter with you? How do you judge? Most of them follow nothing but conjecture can never be a substitute for the truth. God is well aware of what they do. We will now have our interview with Brother Hamza. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Hamza.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, sister.
Thanks for being here today on Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation. Do you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
No worries. My name is Hamza Siddiqui and I'm originally from India. I've moved to New Zealand late in November 2024 and has been here about a year and 9 months. So far, good.
So you grew up in India. Can you tell us about your childhood?
Yeah, I was born in the city known as Allahabad. But then very soon, which maybe less than a month, and I moved to another city, which was about 50 kilometres away from the capital of India. The city is known as Ghaziabad, and I spent the initial 12 years just before turning teen, and we moved back to Allahabad because my father moved over to Saudi. So I was staying with my mum in Allahabad, and I did a little part of my schooling all in Allahabad. City of Allahabad is very colourful. It's known for the confluence of three big rivers in India, one of which has disappeared. And the exact term the city has been described is known as Sangam. Most of our relatives are in the Allahabad. So I think that's the best part of Allahabad. There, you never get bored of anything. I've got my parents. They've got good siblings. My mum's about four sisters and four brothers. And on my father's side, there's six brothers and two sisters. So you can just imagine there are dozens and dozens of cousins. And when you have that many cousins, and almost all of them are similar to your age, all you can think of is the school to end, and then you get to play with all of them together. So, yeah, Allahabad is just anything. And I would look for any opportunity to visit Allahabad because I believe to remain connected to all of my relatives.
And most of them are still there?
Yeah, about 50% of them are there in Allahabad, and 50% of them have moved out, especially to States and Canada. But the good thing is that every year, all of them do come back in July and in August. And there is like good trauma going on. You get screamings because now the cousins, and they've got their own kids, and their kids are also growing up. So the environment is very cheerful and lively, and you get dinners and lunch and rides from everywhere. So I mean, it's very easy and safe to say you can move out of Allahabad, but Allahabad can't move out of you.
So the family reunions is what you look forward to.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you tell us about your family, your siblings growing up?
I've got one sibling who's younger than me. His name is Muneeb, and he's currently pursuing his PhD in hepatitis vaccine in New Delhi. He's currently in his fourth year, and probably he'll be finishing up by the time I'll be finishing my PhD next year. So, yes, apart from that, I've been brought up in Allahabad in a close-knit family with all relatives within being the vicinity of less than a kilometer. So just imagine, like, it's hard to say that I've got one sibling, but I can definitely say that I've got like 15 other siblings.
Yeah.
And we've always looked after each other because we are almost of a similar age. And I think my younger brother is probably more connected to them because he has spent more share of his time, his childhood in Allahabad. So he's more connected to the others. But I mean, it would be unjust for my part to say that I'm least connected, but I'm second to him.
Hmm. What does your parents do back then?
My father used to work in Saudi, and then he came back from Saudi in December 2013. My mother has always been a housewife, and she's the reason that we've been raised to the best just because of her. She's devoted all her time just to look after us. Even my father was living alone back in Saudi, and then she decided to stay back in India and to raise us so that our educations and our values are not compromised.
Mm-hmm.
So I think credits to her.
What was it like going to school in India?
As I mentioned, because I did initial 8 years of my schooling in another city. So it was St. Joseph's Academy in Ghaziabad. The school actually shaped me, prepared me for the next 7 years, starting from class 6 to class 12, making me... getting used to every cultural, every academic, and every literary or any stuff. So I could say the foundation of my initial years were actually made in Ghaziabad. But when we moved to Allahabad, it's there when things started shining up. I got more opportunities to be able to brush up myself, especially in sports. I always wondered, if I had a second chance, I would always move back down to the road of sports. And had I not been a dentist, I would have been a sports person, probably a basketball player, because I did play at the level of a city and I did participated in a 400 sprint level at the state level. I won accolades in almost every track event that is possible. I tried every possible games except never participated swimming at a competition level. But you name it, football, you name it, cricket, you name it, hockey, that's the national sports of India. Basketball and track events. I mean, I've tried my best to excel in sports. And I give credit to my mother for always pushing me, just go on, go on, go on.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still time to have that second life.
Sure.
Did you have any religious studies as part of the school curriculum or at home?
Not as per se as part of my school curriculum. But again, I always believe... the home environment is very important for shaping your religious studies, and my mother took care of that part. She always gave the best possible tuitions. Someone from the masjid used to visit us to give tuitions at home and to teach Quran, especially the tajweed of the Quran, that how the Quran needs to be recited. And that, mashallah, helped me to develop a nice, beautiful qirat. There is one event that I would like to share is that back in 2004, the city of Allahabad did host an interstate Islamic quiz. And I was among the top 10 of the entire state. So that was a very big accolade, and it was a very proud moment for my mother. She still remembers that day when my name was announced in the top 10 category of the entire state of the state Islamic quiz. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the only, as per se, curriculum-based religious studies that I would have done. But otherwise, we've always got home tuitions for religious studies.
Mm-hmm. And sounds like your mom has been a really important part of your education.
Yes,
life.
Absolutely. Even at this stage, she's enrolled herself in learning Arabic, and right now she's excelling in that as well.
Do you have any favorite childhood memories you like to share with us?
Sooner the clock used to strike 5 o'clock, we used to rush to the playground, all my siblings, and especially on the weekends when all of us used to like assemble at one place. So we used to chip in some amount of money from everyone's pocket used to go as we used to buy snacks. You can call it, we used to spend the entire night watching movies and stay sleeping late until next morning, and then probably going out for playing again at 12 o'clock, right from the 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock. So I think we always look forward for the weekends and always looking at the clock when the clock will strike 5 o'clock. We should go to play.
You definitely had a good childhood.
Yes.
Let's talk about your higher education. So tell us what happens after high school.
So once we finished high school, I did my college grade 11 and 12 from the same school. And then I did a health science course, which I majored in biochemistry. And then I got into, that was in the one of the ancient institutions, I'm not sure whether people would be aware, is known as Aligarh Muslim University. And the alumni of that college are around the world. And then I got into the dentistry. That is from King George's Medical University. From there, I did my bachelor's in dentistry. And then I did my master's in dental surgery. That is from All India Institute of Medical Science. Did a 3 years of postgraduate residency. Yeah, and that was the all I did, the higher education in India.
Have you always wanted to be a dentist? Like, was dentistry the path you wanted to take after school?
Not really. I would want it to be a boxer. But sometimes you don't have other options if you come from a small city. When your parents actually ask you, do you want to be a sports person or do you want to study? But the study part seems to be a bit more heavier in the tone. So you actually take up studies. And I wanted to do medicine, but then I never wanted to just keep trying out medicine unless I get into the medicine. When I got the dentistry, I just went to the dentistry. I said, let's go and excel in it.
You then studied in the UK.
Yeah. After finishing my post-graduation in orthodontics, I practiced as a consultant for about 2 years. Life became pretty monotonous. You just go into the clinic, do the same thing back and forth. There is no fun happening. And I've always loved to research. I've always loved to know things behind what is happening behind the stage. So I think, I was safe to say I was not old enough that I still can try a few things in life. So I thought, why not give a shot to do a research? And then I came across this opportunity of doing an research in oral sciences in Glasgow Dental Hospital. Although I never got this scholarship there to study, but I think it was worth giving a shot. So I then moved to Glasgow to study MSc in oral sciences.
Can you tell us a bit about your research?
The course was more purely research-based, and we were actually not in a clinical side, but we were actually looking on the pathology side. I mean, looking for why things happening in mouth. So I was actually faced by one thing, that does the change in the oral health status can actually improve the quality of life in dementia patients. And that was my research, that whether improving the regimen of the oral health of dementia patients can actually improve the scores in their thinking. Unfortunately, my study period was very short. I could not get any affirmative results, but I think it was a very good dimension to look for.
Mm. And you're now doing your PhD at the University of Otago. Can you tell us about that?
When I finished my master's in the UK, I was looking for a PhD in clinical science because I definitely wanted to apply my clinical acumen in the research. So I couldn't get any clinical PhD in the UK. Then I came across an opportunity here in Otago, especially from the Department of Orthodontics. And then I had this research in my mind. Though we had a lot of initial conversations moving around artificial intelligence, but I made up my mind that I do want to do a clinical PhD. So I took up a topic that was on sleep disorder breathing. In a more simple term, it is about sleep apnea and snoring. So I'm actually looking for a new kind of a treatment. It's the aligners, which are the invisible braces, which were initially used to align the teeth. Can those invisible braces be used to treat the sleep apnea and the snoring? And that's what I'm looking in.
And how far are you with your research?
We have started. It's a two-phase clinical trial. It's a randomized crossover trial where I have begun my phase one, and I've got some initial data But still pretty early to say things that, yes, it is working. But I think looking at the data, I'm hopeful to publish something brand new.
Mm. Are you here on a scholarship or personal funding?
I am here on scholarship. And that's the only reason I moved from North Pole to South Pole, that unless I have a scholarship, I wouldn't be relocating from the Glasgow to Dunedin. And so when I got this opportunity for the PhD, it was advertised that the funding would be given, though it is not by the university. It is externally funded by the New Zealand Association of Orthodontists. So that's the organization that is funding my study and providing me the stipend to study here.
When would you finish your PhD?
I am finishing late in November 2027, just hoping to wrap things before that.
Mm. And how do you compare University of Otago with University of Glasgow?
Mm. Both of these universities have got their own merits. The University of Glasgow is the fourth oldest university in the UK. So the campus is like a Harry Potter kind of stuff. Even whenever I stand right in the university chambers, it does give you a feeling that, yes, you are a part of a Harry Potter character. While at the University of Otago, though it has got the structure is derived from the Scottish universities, the good thing about the University of Otago is got places for PhD in dentistry, which unfortunately is not there too many opportunities in University of Glasgow. So both universities have got their merits.
And that's a good observation.
Yeah.
You secured the top rank in All India Medical Sciences Entrance Exam in 2017. Can you tell us about that?
That is a very special part of my life because I think I chipped in every ounce of blood and sweat to get through that. Now, All India Institute of Medical Sciences, New Delhi, hosts examination twice in a year, and they only got about 5 or 6 seats. So, and even in those 5 and 6 seats, they have a reservation. So in May 2017, there was just 1 seat in general category. So I only had one option. If I am All India rank 1, I get the seat. And if I am All India rank 2, I'm good for nothing.
Wow.
So, and what my colleagues describe, because we were living in a rented apartment together. So if I frame my 4 months or 5 months of preparation for that particular exam, they said seeing me would either made them crazy or he's already gone crazy, because I was trying to study even with my head down and my legs up. So that I don't fall asleep. And that too in a 45 degree scorching heat. So I think I tried my level best to get through the exam. And I thought, if there is 1 seat, that is for me. And alhamdulillah, 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 I haven't cried like anything in my life when the results were announced.
Mashallah. And I'm glad that's over for you.
Yes.
You also won awards in King's College Medical University. What was that for?
It's actually King George's Medical University, the same from where I graduated my bachelor's in dentistry. So I was never a fan of studies late until final year, because before then I used to believe studies are only as important as air to breathe and food to live. So, but in final year, I realized, like, I think I should give slightly more time to my studies. And then, I started studying a bit more harder, started giving a bit more, a couple of sleepless nights in a month to excel through, so that at least when I graduate after complete my dentistry, I should have some honours and some medals in my clinical subjects. And alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, finally, when I finished my dentistry, I was awarded as the best student intern of the entire 2011 batch.
Congratulations.
Sakla.
And although you have not finished your PhD yet, Mashallah, you've produced more than a dozen academic papers. Can you tell us some of the findings, the main findings you found?
As I postgraduated in orthodontic residency, so orthodontics does deal with special area, which is known as cleft, people who have their palate divided. So this is one of the area where I am still research. So I was actually researching that how does the supplementary use of growth factors, which can actually improve the healing, which can improve the, which can actually help in any kind of a pathology that develops in those patients. So I was dealing more with the researches which actually combined the trials from the different part of the world, and then you analyze the result together. So my research did say that yes, using the growth factors can actually help people with the clefts.
Mm. What are your future plans after your PhD?
Definitely take a couple of months of rest. Let every ounce of the PhD completely go out of my system and just rethink what I need to do. But I do intend to get registered as a practicing orthodontist in a year or so, so that when I finish and I'm over with my break, I should start also practicing. If not in a private setup, then probably in the university itself.
Are you thinking about staying in New Zealand after?
Because my wife, she has registered here herself with the Medical Council of New Zealand, and I'm sure she got herself registered in the UK, but then I changed my mind, moved from UK to New Zealand, and she has now got registered in New Zealand. If I think to moving anywhere from New Zealand, definitely she would murder me.
Because she's settled here.
Yeah.
In between your studies, you also worked in both India and the UK, and you're also a tutor now. Can you tell us about the various jobs you've had?
So I worked as an independent consultant in India as an orthodontist. And then I moved over to UK because of the regulatory requirements. I cannot practice as a clinician there. I need to have registration. By the time I was applying for the registration there, I was working in a clinic as a dental nurse. It was very important to know the clinical setup, to know the clientele of the UK and what is the attitude of the patients there, how different it is from India. It was very important stuff to learn. So starting as a dental nurse was a very good step. And then I moved up. In the role, I started working as a treatment coordinator. I started working as an assistant practice manager there. It helped me hone my communication skills, especially with the people of Glasgow. The Glasgow is one place where anyone always struggle in the first 7 days just to understand what Glaswegians are actually speaking, because it's the most terrible accent of the entire Scotland. After I moved here in New Zealand, when I joined Yidani, I've been working as a tutor in the simulation clinics. I am teaching undergraduate students of second year and third year about the basic dentistry stuff.
Mm. And you're enjoying that so far?
Yes, absolutely. I enjoy teaching.
Let's talk about your challenges of adjusting to a new society while you're here in New Zealand, but also your experiences in the UK?
When I moved to Glasgow, I think it's just not for me, it would be for everyone. The first challenge would be the horrible, horrendous Glaswegian weather. Glaswegians call us Drich, and the second is the Glaswegian accent. So I had a lab, although I did overcome the weather thing because I enjoy cold weather, so I was happy with that later on. But the accent stuff was very difficult to get over with. So there have been times where in the first 3-4 days when I struggled so much to understand few things that at one occasion a girl thought that I am deaf and dumb. She didn't make a sign language and I felt so embarrassed about it that, okay, it was she was asking, I was at a Subway and she was asking, which bread do I need, whether it's a wheat or whether it's toasted? So it's just to quote my struggle. But later on, I did overcome up with the treatment coordinator job or at the dental clinic. And then, yes, from there on, the journey was very smooth. When I moved here to Dunedin, Dunedin is just like Scotland. In fact, Dunedin is called as Edinburgh of South. So I had no issues with adjusting with the weather because it's pretty similar back in Glasgow. Glasgow is a bit more horrible than Dunedin. The other challenges that I found in Dunedin was that because the topology of the Dunedin, we got more hills, and I was actually staying initially at High Street, so I have to walk 650 meters up. It was very tiring. The access to the public buses are not as frequent as it is in the UK. So that was a very good thing in the UK, the public bus system. But here in Dunedin, it's not like that. So the access to the public travel. Apart from that, I think I'm adjusting well to the Dunedin.
Do you have any experiences like as a Muslim adjusting to new society?
Alhamdulillah. I would say not here in Dunedin and not as well as in the UK because there was a very good Muslim community in the UK, in Glasgow, and I'm very blessed, alhamdulillah, to see the same thing here in Dunedin. Though when I back in the UK, our home was like 100 meters away from the mosque, and right now I'm still far away that I am not able to go to the masjid for the every salah. Apart from that, the way the mosque is conducting the workshops and is engaging the young people, especially people, the students from the universities, and that is a very commendable job. So I think all in all, it looks a very encouraging environment.
Have you had a chance to travel to other parts of the country?
Yes, I did visit Lake Taupo in North Island. That was last year. In South Island, I hadn't been too many places. Just around Dunedin to East Tyree region and just the lookout towns here and there closer to the Otago Peninsula.
Mm. We understand you're here with your family. Can you tell us about them?
I'm here with my wife. Alhamdulillah, we got married back in 2022 and she was staying away for about 9-10 months before she moved on to UK to join me. And then when I moved here to Dunedin, she had to stay back for the 3 months because she needed to complete her experience. And after then, when she moved here, she had to be working in North Island and I was working in South Island. Alhamdulillah, we were blessed with a baby boy last year. That was on 25th of December. But there were a few challenges with him and with the blessings and the words from everywhere. I think I would like to acknowledge every Muslim here in Dunedin for making the words for him, that he has overcome all those big struggles. There are a few challenges, but alhamdulillah, with the words and blessing, he's growing up. My parents have recently joined us from all the way from India, and they're looking after him. It's safe to say that to raise a kid, it takes a village. Mm-hmm. I am blessed that a part of my village here is with me.
Mm, and it's good that you have your parents' support for your small family.
Yes.
You mentioned some mosque activities. Can you tell us the activities that you've been a part of at the masjid?
Yes. I wouldn't say I've been a part of too many activities, but there were a couple of them. The first was, I think the last year, in 2024, when I came in, I think there was a whitewash was going on in masjid. they required volunteers, and I was very happy that I could just chip in and do whatever stuff was possible. The second was in, I think there was a speaker from Australia, and the mosque has been organising these kinds of events every now and then. So I did visit like a couple of events that was last year. But since December 2025, and till date, I haven't been actively engaging with the activities because from the time I just get off from work, I am back to home, get engaged with the kid. Because he struggles a lot with the feeding and he has got a reflux. So one of us has to awake throughout the night. So it's for the first part of the night till 12 o'clock, it's me who's sleeping. And then after that, I'm awake. So yes, it's been tiring, but I think the sooner we just get over with all this stuff, I would like to resume all those activities with the masjid. Like the way these past few events that were, I think one of them was recently, that was a matchmaking event that was organized by a masjid. I think I would have volunteered in to get some bachelors who did ask me that do they have someone in them in the knowledge who a family who's looking for a groom. I wish I could have done something more about it, but if I get an opportunity, I would definitely do that.
Let's talk about India. What can you tell us about Uttar Pradesh, the Indian state that you came from?
Uttar Pradesh is one of the most integral part of Indian political and economic system. By the area, it's the second largest, and by population, it is the largest. And it holds the maximum assembly seats of the nation's parliament. The High Court, the Uttar Pradesh High Court, is known for its infrastructure because it was built by the Britishers when India was the part of the British colonial system. It is a site to be looked after. One should go and visit the High Court structure, and especially because it's located in my city from Allahabad. So I will, whenever anyone comes down to our city, I do take them for a stroll of the State High Court. And there are other places which are very known for. One of is the Muslim scholar universities, such as this known as Deoband. A lot of India's Muslim scholars are graduate from Deoband, the city of Deoband, and it's in Uttar Pradesh. Yeah, I think it's hard to say to count because there are so many good things about Uttar Pradesh because it's a very multicultural state. It's a very multicultural state. It gives you opportunities in terms of jobs. That's all I can say at the moment.
Mm. And what's the Muslim percentage of the people there?
If I'm not wrong, probably it's a second state with by far the maximum Muslim population. Most of them are on the western part of the state. The Muslims of Uttar Pradesh are actually very influential in the country's economic or in country's political system.
Can you tell us about the Islamic background in India?
When Islam was being spread all across the world, it came from the western part of the India, and through them there were after then it followed by the rules of Mughal and so, and that led to the establishment of a lot of mosques, and biggest of them is the Jama Masjid, which is in the capital of the country, New Delhi. And yes, the mosques are very beautiful because of the Persian architecture. In a nutshell, I think India has got a considerable amount of Muslim population, and the value is reflected by the scholars who have graduated from the Islamic universities in India. It's just the way India has been projected. The Muslims are actually able to make a good mark throughout the world.
Is Agra located there?
Yes, Agra is in Uttar Pradesh. Agra is known for one of the wonders of the world, and it's known as the Taj Mahal. Every year, millions of visitors from around the world come and visit there. It's got another place which is known as Red Fort. Agra has been, I'm not sure whether it would be a good thing to say that it's been a capital city for the Mughal emperors. But yeah, there was a good influence of Mughal architecture that was seen in Agra. They've got a famous thing which is known as Buland Darwaza. It is famous for the design on the marbles. We've got Humayun's tomb. Sorry, it's Akbar's tomb there. So Agra is definitely known for its ancient buildings.
Must be a really beautiful place.
Yes.
It seems that since BJP came to power, the Indian Muslims' conditions have deteriorated. Can you tell us if that's the case?
I think it's not deteriorating. They become vulnerable because of the radicalization approach of the government, and based on the RSS ideology from where the BJP takes everything from, the Muslims in India have become vulnerable. At this point, I think there is always there's a chance if a name has a Muslim identity, the punishment for things can go out of stretch. Though the rulings by the court, the High Court and the Supreme Court tries to protect the interest of the minorities, Muslim as a minority. But yeah, the recent couple of years, they've actually seen that, yes, Muslims are a bit more vulnerable under BJP rule.
Can you tell our listeners about the cockroach movement?
Everybody in the world is actually stunned by the movement and the government of the India itself. Just a small satire by one of the Chief Justice of India, and that actually took the entire internet, the entire country by a storm. So the guy who's then in the States, and then he just thought, let's just give this an internet meme. But in less than a couple of months, it took a storm, and then it joined the youngsters from throughout the country to fight actually the transparency of the examinations. There have been a few good episodes of the leakage of the national level examinations, and that actually made I think it was about 10 or maybe, I don't know the exact numbers, but at least about 10 or 12 suicides, and which was not a good sign, because those examinations actually are the ones where when students do pass, they become doctors and engineers. So some youngsters from all over the country, they came over to one place in New Delhi. They staged a protest for about 2 months for protesting against the leakage of the examinations, and they were requiring the resignation of the education minister. They were successful in their demands. And that's what is actually an interesting thing, because so far no other protest in India has risen to such an extent and was so successful that a minister had to resign. So cockroach movement has actually got some is now actually being acknowledged throughout the country. There have been recently few other protests similar to the cockroach movement in the other state for protesting the other against the other leakage of other exams. So I think all in all, youngsters in India, they are actually they're not putting up against the government. Sorry, they are actually putting up against the government. They don't want to just follow the normalcy that the government imposes. They are fighting up for their rights. And that's what the cockroach movement has shown them.
The Gaza genocide has been going on for almost 3 years. And like many people around the world, most probably you are also deeply disturbed by the atrocities. How much did you know about the Palestinian issue before the current genocide began?
Absolutely. I was aware of the atrocities in Palestinians from long while ago, when right from the period when Yasser Arafat was there. But yes, so far recently, after the 2023, how the things have turned up, this is horrific. And not just as a Muslim, I think anyone around the world who has got a sense of humanity would definitely accept that the Palestinians are actually facing the brunt of the worst of the worst of the human atrocities.
Can you tell us about Indian Muslims' attitude towards the genocide? Were there any protests or boycotts?
Not on a very large scale, but yes, there were protests. Especially from the state where I come, there were a few protests organized in the capital of the state, which is Lucknow. But then, because the protesters were cracked down heavily, and the movements were suppressed. But there were a couple of protests, as far as I know, because back then I was in the UK. So it's just not the Muslims. There were even other organizations in New Delhi. There were people in other states who did stage a protest against the atrocities for the Palestinians. So there were a few, but not to the major scale as it's been in the other places in the world.
Do you have any comments on the brutal massacre and genocide taking place despite the so-called ceasefire?
Well, I think if not today, but sometime later, people would have to pay the price for that. It's just that the patience of the Palestinian people is commendable, and the way that they have resisted things so far. I'm always shaken deeply from inside. That despite so many political interventions that have been for the governments across the world, they have tried to stop all these things. They have been suppressed, they have been oppressed. So I think if not today, but later sometime, I'm hopeful things will, they will change.
Do you have any comments on the Muslim countries' apathy and also lack of support for Palestinian causes?
Things have more been on just on paper than the actual support. And I have actually observed this, despite the callings of ceasefire, the the protest from the Muslim countries closer to the state of Palestine, I haven't seen the kind of resistance that was required, the stand that the countries needed to take against the atrocities of Palestine. So it is something which needs to be given a thought, that why do the Muslim countries never took a very strong stand against the for the oppression of the Palestinian people?
India has been reported as a major arms supplier to Israel during the genocide. What can you tell us about India and Israel's close relationship?
India has maintained a very long ties with Israel. I think this is actually based on the ideology, the way the Israel works, and I wouldn't say in per se as the entire country, but because of the current government who is in power in India, they are working, and their ideology is based on RSS, which works in close ties with that in the Israel. So it's not surprising. It would not be surprising that there is an increased arms deal. Because I don't have much information on that, but I do know that the recent political movements, such as the military agreement between the Turkey, Pakistan, and Turkey, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, that was the agreement that happened in Makkah, that has caused much more the Indian government to work more in close ties with Israel to counter the things. So yes, India does maintain a very close relationship. I think there were many workers who had actually willingly wanted to go to Israel and support for the Israeli cause. I don't know how much of that it is true, but yes, that India does maintain its ties with Israel just because of the current government who's in power.
We really appreciate you being here today, Brother Hamza. Before you go, can you please give any advice for the Muslim students at Otago?
Everyone should be thankful to Allah, whatever they have got in the current moment. Because if you have food on your plate and a roof over your head, I think Allah has given you everything. So be thankful for everything that Allah gives you, and keep your prayers and your salah safe. That is something which will always protect you in this world and after this world. Whether the success is about for your career, or whether your success is the life after from here onwards.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, brother.
Jazakallah khair.
Thank you, brother Hamza. Now we listen to an Islamic song in Urdu, Qawwali, in praise of the Almighty Allah by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, entitled "Is Shain Karam Ka Kya Kehna," which roughly translates "How wonderful is this magnificent grace."
Nawazta hai jo sabko wo dil nawaz hai tu niyazmand hai sab aur bhi nijaz hai tu zamane bhar ke banata hai sare bigde kaam kareem sare zamane ka karsaaz hai tu
Shane karam ka kya kehna, dar pe jo sab.
that is the end of our program today. Thank you for your time. Special thank you to RFM for facilitating the production of this program. I should add that the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Otago Muslim Chaplaincy as such. If you have any questions, please email muslimchaplaincy@otago.ac.nz. We hope to see you next time, inshallah. God willing. Assalamualaikum.
You've been listening to Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at OARFM Dunedin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.